Welcome to Insights Now. My name is Jack Manley, and I'm a global market strategist here at JP Morgan Asset Management. Today, I'm joined by my colleagues, Jordan Jackson, also a market strategist, and Katie Korngable, a research analyst with a focus on U.S. equities, all on the Market Insights team. I think we're all excited to play a role in today's episode, where the topic hits very close to home, both personally and professionally. How America's next generation, quote-unquote, of millennials and Gen Z is influencing the economy, markets, and the financial advice profession. Katie, let's start things off with you. You know, one of the things that I think stands out to me about younger Americans in general, Gen Z in particular, is that they typically have a very negative outlook on both the economy and their own financial prospects. Mm-hmm. Now, I got a couple ideas here about maybe why that's the case, but you are our resident Gen Zer here on the day, so I'd love to get your take on why this is happening.
Thanks, Jack. And it is a very interesting and recent phenomenon. I think usually we think of younger people as bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and older people as more cynical or realistic, depending on your worldview. But in 2018, actually, March of 2018, for the first time in survey history, we saw University of Michigan consumer sentiment come in worse for younger generations than for older generations. It was actually a decline that started in 2015. So 2015 to 2018, I personally was in high school, so we might have to turn it over to you guys.
Sure, that feels so bad.
For what was going on then.
Okay,
but,
all right.
But in history, if, you know, Googling serves me well, I think it was actually kind of a similar environment to what we had now. So the Fed had been hiking interest rates for the first time since pre-GFC, which was squeezing or increasing mortgage rates in a housing environment that was already squeezed on the supply side. So we had kind of the housing affordability issue kick in. We had higher interest rates. And then we also in 2018 had trade war 1.0. So it's kind of the first announcement of tariffs with China. And so I think that also led to some concern about just political uncertainty and affordability in general. But that kind of sentiment issue for younger generations versus older generations has persisted. It's bounced around a little bit, but basically from 1978 through almost the end of 2015, we had consistently better sentiment among younger generations, and that's just not the case anymore. And right now, again, it's actually lower than it is for older generations. I think there's some degree of existential angst, right? Like politics, social media are not helping, climate change also not helping. But these generations are also facing a very real set of unique economic challenges.
Yeah.
So I think mainly housing affordability and affordability in general, student loans. And I also think the weak new hire job market, and especially now the concern about AI, is all playing a role. So maybe I'll turn it back to you, Jack, to kind of discuss some of these factors.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you brought up something there very interesting, Katie, which is that, you know, younger Americans are facing a sort of distinct set of problems. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important to point out when we have these conversations, like, you know, Jordan, you and I are millennials. And I feel like millennial for a very long time was a dirty word. Like, people called you a millennial and they meant it as an insult.
They meant you were lazy.
Right, exactly. You're lazy. You're entitled. Like, whatever it happens to be, like, millennial never means a good thing. Like, oh, you're being such a millennial. That's a bad thing when somebody says that. And I like to say that, you know, yeah, maybe we do complain a lot. Maybe we complain a little bit too much, but we complain for a lot of really good reasons. Like, there are a lot of things for us to complain about. And I don't know if it makes me feel better or worse that Gen Z kind of feels the same way, but I think it is a very similar story here, where, like, there are a lot of problems that we are facing as the younger sort of next generation in this country. And it is very much worth unpacking some of these. And so, you know, what I want to focus in on a little bit up front is talking about that affordability issue that you mentioned. And affordability has, of course, become a pretty hot topic right now politically. Everybody's talking about affordability as we're making our way into the midterms at the end of this year. But perhaps it goes without saying, you know, affordability is going to mean different things for different demographics. And to me, the most interesting component of this affordability conversation is when you look at the inflation that you've seen in what I would refer to as, like, necessities. In other words, things that you need to have a healthy, productive life. It's going to be stuff like housing, stuff like healthcare, stuff like education. And the inflation that you've seen in these three categories, it is just eye-watering, particularly on the education front. It far outstrips what you see in the overall CPI basket inflation. And the result of all of this is that almost 40% of all the money, that Americans spend in any given year is dedicated to just those three things. 40% of all the money that we spend goes to healthcare, education, and housing. You know what that number was when our grandparents were our age? It was like 15%. Wow. There has been an enormous uptick in the cost of necessities. And if you think about it, if we're spending more of our cash on those things, which we got to spend money on, it means we have less money to spend on basically everything else, right? And that could be making it harder to build long-term wealth. It could be that it's harder to start a family because it's more expensive to start a family. I mean, frankly, it means it's harder to save for retirement. And honestly, if we want to put the serious stuff aside, it's harder to have fun, right? It's harder to spend money on the stuff that you actually like. And so when I think about this affordability issue, it almost means that younger Americans, I think, are in like a particular need for help when it comes to getting across that financial finish line, so to speak. And Jordan, I'd love to bring you in here on this one. You know, first of all, you are the rare millennial that wears a tie. I'm also one of those guys. So we're sort of already right off the bat anachronistic. But you're even more unusual, I'd like to say. Maybe that's because my own development's been a little bit stunted on this front. But, like, you're a homeowner. You have two beautiful little girls. You're a dad. That's sort of unusual for younger millennials, given some of those issues that I mentioned. And I would, by the way, consider you a younger millennial, because I also consider myself a younger millennial.
Thank you. You're
very welcome. I would love to get your take on affordability, on student loans, and for what it's worth, the housing market, too.
Sure. So I've been lucky enough to where my wife and I were pandemic movers. So we actually moved from New York to D.C. in 2021, locked in a 2.5% mortgage rate.
It's like free money.
It's like free money.
Oh.
And we bought a home 5 years ago in D.C. We also, again, lucky enough, very blessed to be able to buy a home in New York about 30 minutes north of the city about 6 months ago. Now, what I would say, just to put the affordability context into perspective, and I recognize DC, New York, very different cities, very different housing market, but locking in a 2.5% 30-year mortgage 5 years ago, relative to the roughly 6.25% mortgage that I locked in 6 months ago, my fixed cost, this is just mortgage and principal, interest and principal, total mortgage rate, my fixed cost increased 3x. Now, let's put this into perspective in terms of wage inflation, right? If the average wage inflation for the average American has been roughly 3%, do you know how long it would take for someone receiving a roughly 3% increase on their salary to 3x their income?
I probably don't want to know.
37 to 38 years.
Ah.
And my fixed cost increase in 5. Yeah. Right. So when you put that into perspective, you don't have to go back very far to get a sense of how intense the affordability challenge has been over the last 5 years. So I think that does help to put things into perspective. You know, also the fact that we're working a lot longer, well into sort of retirement and grandparent age. You know, 30 years ago, you mentioned that I have two daughters, 30, 40 years ago, you might be able to depend on grandparents to help you out and take care of your kids. I've got additional daycare costs, right? Nanny costs, daycare costs for two kids. And so all these things are compounding. And then you've also mentioned student loans. I graduated the University of Virginia 11 years ago. You know, we work at JP Morgan, pretty decent job. Mm-hmm. I am still paying off my Bachelor of Arts degree from the University of Virginia 11 years ago.
What's the rate on that, by the way, just out of curiosity?
So I was smart enough to refinance all of my student loans into one lump sum payment.
Oh, you are smart.
When rates got really, really low.
Okay.
So luckily that's at a 4.5%. But when I initially took out those student loans, we're talking 8-9%.
And what, the Fed funds rate was like zero.
Exactly.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. And so, you know, I sort of had some of those benefits and was smart enough to do some of that refinancing. But again, the affordability is a lot challenging. We're taking on a lot costlier and more additional things to pay for than a lot of our previous generations. So it is a real challenge. And if we want to break this down demographics, the second point that you mentioned I think was really key is the importance of financial literacy and how do the younger generations, while we may not feel great, do make the right decisions to set ourselves up for financial success in the future. And you know, let's break this down to some demographics. So it's fascinating. What creates wealth? Home ownership, investments, owning stocks, business creation. And if you look at, again, demographics, let's focus on Black, Hispanics, other and white households. So white households, home ownership rates right around 75% as of the fourth quarter of last year, of 2025. For Hispanic households, it's right about 48%. For Black households, it's just 44%.
It's a huge drop.
So it's a huge drop off, right? And so when you think about the on a go forward basis, the need for home ownership, very similar statistics in terms of stock ownership. White households have roughly 60 to 65% ownership. That number drops off dramatically for Black and Brown households. And then ultimately, what's really fascinating is, you know, kind of bringing this out at a high macro level, Black and Hispanics account for about a third of the population, 25% of consumer spending, but only 5 to 6% of wealth in America. And so it's so important, this sort of financial literacy component for upcoming generations, Gen Z's, millennials, but also, you know, across different demographics. And a big piece of this is also labor markets, right? How job creation, AI, how is this transforming the labor market? How can younger folks retool themselves to be dangerous in this next phase? So maybe, Jack, talk a little bit about your perspective on labor markets and how this all maybe ties in.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned some disparities there in terms of racial demographics. You mentioned wages in general. All of this stuff is showing up in labor data as well. You know, if you look at unemployment rate statistics in general, and I can say this about age-based demographics, in general, the labor market's tighter now than it has been over most of history. But it's looser on a relative basis for those of us in particular under the age of 24, but for those of us even under the age of 34, this is a much looser labor market. We're much less likely to find employment. I think you feel that or find that, I should say, particularly acutely with recent college graduates. I mean, you know, I think we're all like blessed to be in a really interesting role, a very high profile, kind of highly visible role. I don't know about you. I bet you I do know this, though. Like, I get so many inbound requests through social media platforms about like, hey, can we talk about, you know, a job? I just graduated from XYZ. I have 4,000 applications out and nobody's responding to me. Mm-hmm. The labor market has really deteriorated, particularly for those really young individuals, those people that are looking to, you know, kick off their careers. And I guess you could ascribe some of that to what's happening with artificial intelligence and the fact that AI is helping to make some of those very junior level entry roles somewhat redundant. From my own personal perspective, that feels kind of short-sighted for businesses to think that way, but maybe you're very welcome. We're all giving each other kudos up here. Maybe that's what's going on. I'm not sure, but that's like a really sobering reality, seeing all these people graduating from great schools, and for what it's worth, like way more accredited than I was when I was applying for jobs, just striking out like day after day, month after month. The other thing that I think is really interesting here is when you look at what's going on with wages over the past, I don't know, 40 years or so, maybe a little bit more than that, you can track wage growth by age group in this country. The inflation adjusted median wage for those of us between 18 and 24, so that's going to encapsulate a decent amount of Gen Z, has actually declined over that time period. Like, think about how much richer this country is, how much more access we have to everything. The median wage for young Americans has declined.
Wow.
For those of us under 34, it's up like 1%. But if you're 50, your median wage is up 10% from where it was at the end of the 1970s. I think that contributes further to some of this angst, some of this unease that we feel as younger Americans.
Looking for industry-leading insights on markets and the economy? Our Guide to the Markets illustrates a comprehensive array of market and economic histories, trends, and statistics through clear charts and graphs. For more information on the guide, visit our website at jpmorgan.com/GTM.
Thank you for the question, Jordan. I'm gonna bounce it back to you.
Yeah, Jack. I think you know, we've all hit on a lot of key points categorizing some of the challenges. You know, Katie spent some time talking about the weaker consumer sentiment, particularly across the Gen Z and younger cohorts. Maybe shift that a little bit and talk a little about kind of the spending patterns that you're seeing underneath the hood. I know you spend a lot of time also looking at earnings and corporate earnings. Like, how are younger generations shifting their spending?
So one thing I would say is that younger generations definitely do feel bad, as we've all discussed. And that is a very real problem, not just for their therapists, right? But also for economic and earnings growth. Mm-hmm. Gen Z and millennials are now kind of depending on what metrics you look at, but it's well over half the working age population. They now account for about as much spending as Gen X and Boomer, so total spending. But the really important part here is that they're essential to spending growth. So if we think about, you know, maybe older people spend more money because they just have more stuff, but younger generations are the ones who really grow that spending. So in the first couple of years, right, your income grows rapidly as you get your first job. And then also your spending grows rapidly with your responsibilities, right? Like you mentioned, car, kids, all of these things really happen when you're younger. So if we look at our Chase credit card spending data, on average, in 2025, millennials and Gen Z grew spending 7x faster than boomers, and it's about 4.5x faster than Gen X. Mm. So it's really important for companies to kind of tap into this. And obviously, things, especially on the cost side, are bad, but they do have some money to spend. And I think one thing that can help on the income side is if you look at younger generations versus older generations, prospects do look a little bit better after you adjust for things like taxes and transfers.
Okay.
So maybe wage growth has slowed, but after taxes and transfers, it kind of does look like each generation is a little bit better off than the previous at the same age.
I would argue, for what it's worth, that the transfers shouldn't be necessary if the wage growth was where it should have been. But anyway, I'm sorry.
Very important.
I feel like that's almost cheating, even though that is probably cheating. The correct way to think about it intellectually. But I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
Yeah. Well, I think what's interesting is a lot of the things that we've kind of discussed, like, we're not necessarily seeing it in spending or corporate earnings right now, but longer term for the economy, mm-hmm. right? Like, these are bad, very bad things, mm-hmm. even if we're not necessarily seeing it in earnings. Like, I think one good example is if people are delaying purchases like houses or having kids because of affordability, that's really bad for the economy longer term, right?
Right.
Declining birth rates. Mm-hmm. But if you actually look at current disposable income, if they feel like these things are so out of reach that they're not saving in the same way, it can actually mean, you know, more spending for consumer packaged goods companies.
Yeah.
So a lot of times, like, to your point, what's good for companies is not good, like, longer term.
Or they just ultimately won't spend those dollars at all.
Yeah.
If you think you can't afford to go to college, maybe you won't go to college.
Yeah.
And now if that has a cascading effect, now you start to look at quality of living in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And that could erode very gradually, but over a very, very long period of time. So to your point, it's almost feels existential crisis.
It definitely is. And we actually see that in a lot of survey data, right? Obviously, surveys are not science. And these population, like the sample sizes, tend to be really low. But a couple really interesting trends do come up for younger generations. One, they report doom spending.
Mm-hmm.
So a very significant portion of Gen Z and millennials report doom spending. And the majority of Gen Z actually says that seeing bad news on social media makes them stress spend.
Okay.
So, outside
that's retail therapy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Retail therapy. So outside of the really fundamental reasons that Gen Z and millennials are growing spend quickly, there are also kind of these sentiment psychological aspects, with one being doom spending. I think two, there's a little bit of a different definition of discretionary versus non-discretionary relative to older generations. We actually see younger generations cite things like health and wellness spending, so fitness memberships or skincare products or beauty, and experiences like travel and dining out as essential spending, whereas older generations might not have felt the same way. Mm. That's kind of one boon for these companies as they're trying to entice cautious, bad-feeling younger people to spend. And so
that's why I always get knocked on for having a Starbucks every single morning.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. I got you.
But you'd probably say that's essential to your mental health and what you need to get
like
today.
Iced coffee
for your kids.
Everybody has coffee.
Yeah. So like a little bit different there. So what I would say, kind of everything we've said, like people are feeling bad. But to your point, Jack, we're not necessarily seeing that translate into spending for consumer companies. So they have to entice younger people to spend, but they are able to do so. Some of the interesting ways we see them doing that. One, I would say younger generations, and maybe you guys have experienced this, have different priorities. So we talk a lot about value, right? Mm-hmm. So I think feeling like you're getting a good deal, like you want to spend, but you need to feel like you're getting a good deal. And also innovation. Like if companies can come out with really cool new products, people are like, oh my gosh, I need it. And they'll still spend. So things like differentiated marketing play a role in that. And despite all the talk about younger generations being addicted to their phones, we actually apparently love in-person experiences. So you see that come up for travel companies. I think a really good example is cruises. So cruises are having a resurgence.
No way.
Yes, Jack. Cruises are cool.
Stunning.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. I'm going on a cruise for my 5-year anniversary.
There you go.
And I actually heard you mention the other day that you might consider
I would consider it. Yeah. Yeah, maybe I'll join Jordan and his wife on their anniversary cruise.
So they're really winning at the intersection of value and experiences. And then we also see companies actually like reinvesting in brick and mortar and not just having stores, but curating in-store experiences. So companies like Coach, right, or Tapestry, which owns Coach, is an S&P 500 company. They're inviting Gen Z celebrities to beautiful looking stores that people can put pictures on their Instagram of. So everything like that is helping younger generations spend more. And then the other thing is they do have some very specific preferences, like we talked about. So health and wellness. I think one good example is like people do feel bad. So they're pulling back on maybe some of the casual dining out, like, oh, I don't feel like cooking, so I'm getting Chipotle. Like rather than doing that, maybe they're doing a little more food at home. But young people also love protein. They also apparently love sauces. With 90% of Gen Z saying they would try a restaurant just for a new sauce. And we also, I guess, love beverages, with 3/4 of Gen Z trying a new beverage every single month.
What?
So these kind of challenged fast casual companies are getting earnings growth by leaning into protein, by creating beverage fountains with different kinds of beverages, by adding new sauces.
Yeah.
So that's enticing spend.
I'm talking about
it. I know.
That's ridiculous.
And it's funny because it's so real, because one, I'm admittedly working through all the Celsius flavors while I'm on the road to make sure I'm awake. And then two, the second thing you mentioned about value, feel like you're getting a deal. You know, I don't know. I'm sure you go shopping with your wife, Jack, as I do. And, you know, if my wife likes a purse and say it's $800, but it's on sale for $500,
it's a good
we
deal.
Saved $300.
Money if you can buy it.
But no, the math is we saved $300. Yeah.
I think they call that girl math.
Okay. I wasn't sure if I should say it, but the girls.
Yeah, yes, it's all right.
Yeah, that's why I'm on the podcast.
Thank you, Katie.
Yeah, so like very, very interesting ways that people are enticing spend. And the other thing I think, so we see fast casual restaurants are challenged, but in terms of like simple luxuries, you know, people want to dine out.
Yeah.
It's like 80% of millennials, and I feel like I've also heard this a lot from you guys, view dining out as a social plan, right? And actually the majority of Americans, according to OpenTable, now say that the Instagrammableness of a restaurant is like very important to them when selecting a restaurant. So again, pulling back on kind of that basic everyday I'm eating out spend because I feel bad, but investing in dining out is like an experience to prioritize. Maybe the one other one that's kind of funny is we kind of talked about like protein enticing people to spend. We see the same thing with consumer packaged goods companies, right? Okay. So that really aren't doing well because of tariffs, because of higher costs, but they are finding growth in kind of these niche areas that Gen Z loves. Like Gen Z loves nicotine again. So like that's helping companies. Gen Z loves protein. So that's helping companies. If you look at Amazon Prime Day 2025, the first most purchased product was protein shakes. The third most purchased product was liquid IV.
Okay, I don't think they sell cigarettes on Amazon.
No, they don't. But if that's not, you know, Gen Z males in a nutshell, like showing up at Amazon Prime Day.
Wow.
I don't know what is.
That is impressive. So, I mean,
yeah.
You know, a good amount of spend, a lot of experiential.
Yes.
For what it's worth, I feel like we all kind of see that day in, day out. You know, I feel like I've always said when we talk about real estate with our clients, that the mall is not dead, it's just different, right? Mm-hmm. Like you don't go back to school shopping at the mall anymore, mm-hmm. but you definitely go for the restaurant or the bar yeah. or the spin class or the salon or like whatever it happens to be. I also think it's kind of interesting to point out here that, you know, as you say, Katie, like Gen Z, millennials, they're ramping up their spending in mm-hmm. a big way, but the wealth isn't mm-hmm. there just yet, right? They make up this huge component of spending, but they only control like 10% of U.S. household yeah. worth. Mm-hmm. Maybe boomers still control more than half of it. And I think that this kind of outsized disproportionate spending is perhaps attributable to your point, the fact that we are sort of in our prime, you know, earnings growth mm-hmm. period. Like as you move into your late 30s, early 40s, it's really hopefully when you start, you know, making more money. I wonder if some of it may even have to do with some of those problems that we talked about earlier, where like if it's more expensive, if you're not Jordan and it's yeah. like more expensive to buy a home so you don't buy one, and it's more expensive to start a family so you wait, and when you do you have a smaller family, maybe you do have more cash flow to throw at like the salon yeah. or like your new beverage of the month or whatever it happens yeah. to be that people are spending on. But no, I think it's really, really interesting. Thank you for chiming in on that.
Yeah, and you said, you know, you can't believe we're talking about it, but like what I couldn't believe, like S&P 500 companies are talking about this stuff. Like
yeah.
this is a vital source of earnings growth, particularly in the most challenged areas, consumer staples.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think we were going to talk a little bit about the youth effect. Is that right? That was the last thing we wanted to kind of hit on
yes,
today.
Yes, definitely. I think the other thing we see, I think not just in the economy, but also markets, is that younger generations are starting to have an impact on financial markets, mm-hmm. especially when we think about things like day trading or crypto or, you know, more speculative behavior. So as our resident crypto expert, but also our resident investing principles expert.
Oh, yeah. I'm all over the place.
What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it comes down to how these different generations have experienced markets kind of through, I don't know how I would put it, maybe like their investable lifetimes, right? Like you're not investing, I would hope, when you're like five. You know, you're investing once you get a little bit of money. Maybe that's the end of college. Maybe it's the start of your career. You know, millennials, like people our age, Jordan, we have had by far and away the worst experience as investors. Like we basically kicked it off with the financial crisis. We had COVID halfway in between. Mm-hmm. Our S&P 500 annual returns are like at the bottom of the stack.
Wow. Well,
you look at Gen Z by contrast, and it's been like nothing but sunshine and rainbows. Like, you know, we've had some volatility, but the market always bounces back.
Yep.
Your annualized returns are like in the high double digits. I really wonder if those respective experiences
yeah.
kind of shape how we think about investing. Like, you know, are millennials a little bit more gun shy? Are they like, oh, you know, this stuff just doesn't work for me. It worked for my parents, it worked for my grandparents. It doesn't work for me. Are they, on the other hand, like totally nihilist? And they're like, well, you know, I'm basically out of luck anyway, so I might as well go all in and shoot the moon and see what happens.
Yep.
You know, are Gen Z basically like too risk tolerant for their own good?
We're geniuses, actually.
Exactly. That's like you're never wrong. The market only goes up. So like
the market only goes up.
It only goes up. So I do think that helps to explain why you've had this rise in what I refer to as almost like alternatives. Like,
yeah.
you know, when we think about alternatives, we think private equity or infrastructure. But like crypto, as you mentioned,
yes.
is a huge one. Single stock, like large concentrated single stock positions, options trading, borrowing on margin, day trading mm-hmm. through apps. Like all this stuff is something you very much see, particularly for younger individuals. And I guess, you know, the way that I'd sort of close that comment out is saying it works until it doesn't, mm-hmm. right? And it's another example of how these generations are shaping the investable landscape. They're shaping the financial advice community. And I think understanding that psychology there is actually really, really helpful for those financial advisors looking to figure out how to engage more actively, more proactively mm-hmm. with a cohort of Americans that may not necessarily be super familiar with what those services might be.
And Jack, you made an incredible point where, you know, getting investing, you know, opening up that brokerage account, putting your first dollar in the market, it's empowering.
Yeah.
And I think many millennials feel empowered to take on that responsibility within their own portfolios and future financial success. But I would say for many folks in our line of business and financial advisors, this is still a people business, right? Mm-hmm. And I would argue that Gen Zers, you can correct me if I'm wrong, millennials, when we start to get to the point where we want to truly manage our wealth in
yeah.
a prudent fashion, we want to talk to somebody.
Absolutely.
It is very important that we don't want an AI agent to do our entire portfolio, and we want to talk to somebody because there's still that trust element.
Yeah.
And that goes a very long way. And I think that's where you know, advisors and what we do in our line of business, that won't go away.
Absolutely. All right. Well, so much to discuss and so little time. I think we are going to have to leave it there for today. Thank you, Jordan, Katie, for joining me today. I think this is a really great conversation. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to another episode of Insights Now. We will see you next time.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed J.P. Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of J.P. Morgan Chase & Co. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. J.P. Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.